My name is Dr. Adair Richards. I'm Science Communications Fellow here at the University of Warwick. And today I'm talking to Dr. Matt Hicks, a biochemist here in the Department of Chemistry. So Matt, can you tell me, first of all, what exactly is a biochemist?
A biochemist studies biological molecules using chemical techniques. So we're interested in the chemistry of living systems.
And how did you get involved in this field?
I'd always wanted to be a scientist of some sort, and I was always fascinated with how things worked, particularly living systems. So when I was looking for a university course to do, I looked around for the types of courses that would inform me about these living systems, and biochemistry was the course that I came up with.
Excellent. And so how would you describe biomolecules, and what is their role in your work?
Most biomolecules are polymers, and by polymer what I mean is that they're made up of building blocks of smaller molecules to make a larger molecule that has a specific function. Now, biomolecules come in different flavours, different types. The types of biomolecules that I look at are proteins that do a lot of the jobs in the body, like making something, turning something from one thing into another thing. So they're involved in things like metabolism. They form the building blocks in cellular structures. And
so a lot of your work involves biomolecules. Could you explain a little bit about what they are and what their function is?
So biomolecules carry out all the jobs within your body. There are different types of biomolecules, some of which you may have heard of, some of which you may not. So different types of biomolecules are proteins, DNA, RNA, lipids, carbohydrates, and a few other ones that we may talk about later on. So the different types of biomolecules perform different roles. So for example, DNA, the job of DNA is to encode your genetic code. The job of proteins is varied, so they may act as little factories to turn one type of molecule into another type of molecule. It may act as a scaffold, so they form structures within cells to hold cells in the correct shape. They may act as signaling molecules to take information from one part of your body to another part of your body. Other types of biomolecules, like lipids or fats, perform multiple roles as well. They can also be signaling molecules, and they also have an important structural role. So lipids or fats are found in a membrane layer, a bit like a skin of a balloon, around all of the cells in living organisms. And that membrane, that lipid membrane, is important for many things. A, it keeps the cell contents inside in one place, so it holds the cell juice together. And B, it provides a selective barrier between the outside and the inside, by which I mean molecules on the outside combine to the outside of the membrane to a particular molecule that might be floating around in the membrane, cause a change in that, and transfer information from the outside to the inside.
So what are most biological membranes made up of? Is it all the same stuff?
No, they're made up of lots of different types of molecules. So typically, a membrane around the outside of one of your cells would be made up of about half lipid, which is fat, which is in a sort of fluid conformation. And there'll be other types of molecules in there. So there'll be lots of proteins in there. There'll be carbohydrates. There'll be sterols, so things like cholesterol that you may have heard of. Cholesterol's important in the structural integrity of your membrane. So although cholesterol is often portrayed as a bad thing, you do require cholesterol, a small amount of it.
One of the projects you've been working on has been looking at some of the components of mad cow disease. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, mad cow disease is caused by a change in the conformation of a protein called the prion protein. What happens is if you have an abnormal form of this prion protein, and it's abnormal because it's in a odd shape, what that can do is bind to normal forms of the protein and turn the normal protein into the abnormal form. And this can propagate throughout your body and form toxic compounds that cause disease. This is the basis of the infection part of mad cow disease.
So what's a normal prion? Where does it live? What does it do?
That's a really good question. The function of the normal prion protein is unknown. Now, there are some proposed functions for it, but we're not quite sure what the normal function is. Where it's found in the cell is actually on the outside of the cell. So you have your lipid membrane around the cell. The prion protein's on the outside, and it's anchored to that lipid membrane through a lipid tail that's attached to the protein.
So this disease comes from cows, and do we know how eating the bad meat changes your prions?
The route of infection is unclear. What is clear is that some of the abnormal protein from the cow into your body, and it must cross the barrier from your digestive tract into the body somehow, and that changes the normal protein into the abnormal form.
Okay, and this abnormal form of prion, what does it do? Why is that a bad thing?
Again, this is why we need research in this area. The final abnormal form of the protein forms these big clumps. Now, it may not be the case that these big clumps are the thing that's toxic. It might be an intermediate on the way to forming those things. And that's one of the things that the research in the area is looking at.
And so what about your own contribution to this field? What is it that you and your colleagues have done?
What we were interested in was taking the protein, instead of studying it in isolation, so just floating around in solution, what we wanted to do was take the protein and put on a lipid anchor, as is found in nature, and attach it to lipid membranes and change the composition of the lipid membranes and the environment around the protein attached to the membranes and see how that affects the structural conformation.
How do you go about adding something to a protein as small as that?
The approach we took was to make the protein in bacteria. The reason we do it that way is because you can make lots of pure protein by tricking the bacteria into making it for you. We then chemically synthesized, using organic chemistry techniques, we chemically synthesized the lipid anchor part. And when we'd made the protein in the bacteria, we put an extra bit on the end that we knew would react with the chemically synthesized lipid anchor and form a single molecule.
So what bit was that you added?
The bit that we added was an extra amino acid, and that amino acid's called cysteine. Cysteine is a slightly unusual amino acid in that it's got a reactive sulfur group on the outside, and we know how to manipulate that to make it form a covalent or permanent bond with other types of molecules.
Excellent. So you've managed to attach this anchor, this thing that you've made, onto a human prion protein. So what happens next?
We didn't use the human prion protein.
Right.
We used a prion protein from a hamster.
Okay. And why did you choose a hamster?
A few different reasons, but one reason was a safety reason. So there's a high barrier between different species for transmittance of the disease. Although this disease has managed in some rare cases to transfer between cows and humans, there's an additional level of safety in using the hamster prion protein.
So you've attached this anchor molecule onto a prion from a hamster, and what do you do next?
We then take that molecule and we use this lipid anchor part to embed it in model membranes.
What's a model membrane?
So the reason,
are we talking computer models here?
No, I use the word model because what we're doing is we're using different types of lipids that you might find in different areas of the cell membranes in humans in order to look at how the different properties of those lipids affect the structure of the protein. So different properties of lipids might be the charge on the top part of the membrane, on what we call the head group, so you can have either neutral, positive or negative charges, and that can have effects on other biological molecules by either repelling them or attracting them. And other types of properties of lipids that are really important are what we call the degree of saturation. The degree of saturation is the same thing that you might hear about with when people talk about polyunsaturates and saturated fats. So generally, if you've got something that's saturated, it forms a solid at room temperature. So things like butter, lard, animal fats, they tend to be more saturated. And fats and lipids from plants tend to have more unsaturation in them. And the unsaturation means that the chains that pack together are more flexible. So they can't pack together as tightly, and they make more fluid lipids. So unsaturated things tend to be oils, and saturated things tend to be what we call fats.
Excellent. So you've got this model membrane, and how do you look at how the prion inserts or doesn't?
So what we do with in that particular situation, we use a type of spectroscopy called infrared spectroscopy. And what spectroscopy means is you shine light at something and see what light comes out the other side. Different types of light interact with biological molecules in different types of ways. And you would use different types of light, different types of spectroscopy, depending on what type of effects you were trying to monitor within the protein. In the case of the prion protein attached to lipid membranes, what we were trying to look at was the overall shape of the protein. And a good way of doing that when you've got something attached to a surface is by using infrared spectroscopy. The reason we use infrared light to shine at the molecule is because the energy of infrared light is just right so that when it interacts with certain types of molecules, it will stretch and bend the bonds within the molecules. And the way in which it does that gives us information on the shape and structure of the protein.
So you're shining this infrared light, and that's changing the way that the bonds between the molecules are. So that they, you're saying that they stretch or bend somehow?
Yeah.
Do you know how that process happens?
Yeah, what happens is for, and this is the case for a lot of types of spectroscopy, a bond will have a particular energy at which it likes to absorb light. So, for example, if the bond between two amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, that will absorb infrared light at a certain known wavelength, and it will bend or stretch. Now, if we put those two amino acids in a different conformation relative to each other, so we change the shape of the protein, the energy at which that absorbance or that interaction of the infrared light with the bond happens, the energy of that interaction will change slightly. And from previous work that's been ongoing for decades, we know what those small changes mean in terms of changes in structure.
So you shined this infrared light on the prion with its anchor to it. What did you discover?
To our surprise, we discovered that when the molecule was anchored to the membrane, it actually stayed clear of the membrane. Initially, we were expecting the molecule, when it was anchored to the membrane, to interact much more closely with the lipids. This wasn't the case. And the structure that we found when it was anchored to the membrane was very similar to the structure that we found free in solution. Now, this at first was a disappointing result because we were expecting to see big changes when we moved from the free floating system to something anchored to the membrane. However, it was an extremely important result because it meant that the huge body of work that had been done previously on free floating protein in solution was still valid, and all the information that we gained from that could be used to take forward in the field.
It seems like, whereas you expected this protein to change conformation quite dramatically when it was interacting with a membrane, it seems to somehow stick to the edge of the membrane without changing conformation. Is that right?
No. The prion protein, when it's floating around, not attached to the membrane via a lipid anchor, can still associate with membranes of certain types. So if you have a particular charge on the membrane, it will still associate with it and change conformation. Now, what we wanted to find out was the membranes that it didn't associate with, if it was floating around free in solution, if we then anchored the protein to the membrane, would it then, because we brought it closer together and constrained it from floating away, would it then show an interaction? We were expecting the answer to be yes, but as is often the case in science, we were wrong. If we knew all the answers, we wouldn't need to do the experiments. So this told us the membranes that the prion didn't want to associate with when it was floating around free in solution, it still wouldn't associate even if it was anchored in the membrane, as is the case in nature. If we would have found that you get a huge difference by anchoring the protein to the membrane, we would have had to have used different types of techniques that aren't as established and perhaps aren't as powerful yet. The advantage of knowing that we can study the protein free in solution is that we can use these established and more powerful techniques.
Such as?
NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, which is a technique that can give you lots of different types of information, but it can give you information right down to the atomic level. So it means you can identify specific conformations of the protein.
Another part of your research is in developing new types of antibiotics. There's been antibiotics around for decades and decades. Why do we still have to invent new ones?
The reason we need new antibiotics is because the existing ones become ineffective. The way in which they become ineffective is because bacteria develop resistance to them. Now, the way in which that works is in a population of bacteria, you'll have a genetic diversity, like we do in human populations. We're all a little bit different. Now, some of those bacteria may be slightly better at coping with an antibiotic than other ones within that population. Now, what's happened, unfortunately, over the years is that if antibiotics are administered incorrectly or at low doses, some of those bacteria that are better coping with the antibiotics survive. They produce lots more bacteria that have got a genetic diversity as well. And there's a chance that within that new lot of bacteria, there's one that's even better at dealing with the antibiotic. And because bacteria reproduce very quickly, they can go through several generations very quickly. They can go through an evolutionary process, which results in bacteria that are resistant to the particular antibiotic that we're using. So through that process, the antibiotics that exist now quickly become ineffective.
So what work have you been doing on this?
Well, there are lots of different types of antibiotics and lots of good approaches to how you can design new ones. One of the ways in which you can do that is by using molecules, peptides, so small proteins, that make holes in the membranes around bacteria. And they do this by binding to the bacterial membrane, so binding to the surface of these lipids that surround the bacterial cells. They group together in an organized way, and they punch holes in the bacteria, so the contents of the bacteria leaks out and the cell dies.
This seems like a great idea, but surely they would attack human cells as well.
Yeah, that's the tricky bit. So it's relatively easy to design a peptide that will make a hole in any type of lipid membrane. But the difficult bit is designing something that will make holes in bacterial membranes, but not in human membranes. We're lucky because bacterial membranes are different to human membranes. Human membranes have got different components in, so you get things like cholesterol in human membranes that you don't find in bacterial membranes. And bacterial membranes have a much higher negative charge on them. So the surface of the membrane is negatively charged. So often you'll find a lot of these antibiotic peptides have a positive charge on them, so that they're attracted to the negatively charged bacterial membranes. And this is what we call specificity. So the peptide will have a higher specificity for the bacteria than it would for the human.
How do these peptides punch a hole through the membrane?
That's one of the things that we're trying to find out. There are different models for how these peptides punch holes in the bacterial membranes. For example, one's called the carpet model, where the peptides just bind to the surface of the membrane like a carpet. They get in between the lipid molecules and disrupt them in that way. Another model is called the barrel stave model, where a few peptides bind to the surface of the membrane, and then they insert across the membrane. They arrange themselves in a circular fashion with a hole in the middle that lets the contents of the bacteria leak out.
So that the function of these membranes seems to be quite a lot be like a big sack keeping things in. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So it forms what we call a semi-permeable membrane. It keeps most things in or out, but there are specialist areas of the membrane that will let certain things in or out in a controlled manner.
What work have you been doing on this?
What we've been concentrating on is trying to work out the mechanism whereby the peptides bind to the surface of the membrane and how they get into the membrane to make the holes in the membrane. And the way in which we've been going about this is by developing a spectroscopic technique called linear dichroism spectroscopy.
Linear dichroism spectroscopy. What exactly is that? How does that work?
The way in which this works is we make membranes consisting of the lipids that we're interested in studying, so either ones from bacteria or ones from humans. We use a special type of apparatus that stirs the membranes around and aligns them in a particular direction, a bit like when you stir spaghetti around in a pan, it all lines up in the direction that you're stirring it. We then put the peptides in with the lipids. If the peptide binds to the lipid, the peptide then becomes aligned as well. Now the important bit is that the peptides aren't big enough to become aligned themselves if they're not bound to the membrane.
So is that to do with turbulence?
It's to do with shear flow. A molecule has to be long and thin in order to flow a line under the conditions that we're using. And the peptides that we're using are too short and fat to align.
So when they're travelling around in this solution, they can be any orientation?
Yeah.
So that means a net orientation of zero, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
So then, if we've got our aligned membranes with a peptide attached to them, we then want to know what orientation the peptide's bound to the membrane. And the way in which we do this is by using polarised light. So polarised light, you can just think of as light with all the light beams going in one particular direction. So first of all, we shine the light polarised in the direction of the alignment, and we measure how much comes out the other side. And then we shine light polarised at 90 degrees to that, and measure how much comes out the other side. The difference between the two is the linear dichroism signal. So dichroism just means two types of light. And it's called linear dichroism because we've polarised the light in a linear fashion.
Presumably, if the peptide bound in different ways, you'd see a different spectra coming out.
Exactly. The light interacts with the peptide in a different way depending on the orientation of the peptide relative to the membrane.
So when you use this technique, linear dichroism, on these peptides and membranes, what is it that you discovered?
Well, to our surprise, we found that there are processes that take a much longer time than was previously thought. So using other types of spectroscopic techniques, there are processes that happen very quickly on a millisecond and second timescale, which we also saw. But in addition to that, we saw slower processes that take minutes or tens of minutes.
What kind of processes are we talking about?
These were processes that were to do with the rearrangement of the peptides and the actual insertion into the membranes. So whereas previously it was thought that these fast processes where you see a change in a spectroscopic signal were reflecting the insertion of the peptide into the membrane, we think that's not the case. We think that was just those fast processes are just the peptide binding to the outside of the membrane, and it takes a much longer time for it to rearrange and make those holes in the bacterial membrane for it to actually work. And this is important because it means that it takes longer for it to work than was previously thought.
Although it might have bound to the membranes very fast, what you've shown is that it can actually take a much longer time for it to begin to insert in the membranes. What kind of time scale are we talking about?
It's tens of minutes rather than seconds. So we need to remember that this isn't in the natural membranes. These are in membranes that we've made in the lab. And the reason we've done that is because we can make the membranes out of particular components so that we can narrow down what components are important in these processes of insertion. So bacterial membranes have a higher negative charge on them than human membranes. So one of the types of experiments that we might do is take membranes that have a higher negative charge than another set of membranes and look at the difference in the kinetics or the speed at which these processes occur. By controlling the components that are in the membranes rather than just taking the naturally occurring ones, we don't just have to have one or the other. We can have ones that are in between as well. So we can see that as we gradually change the charge, for example, on the membrane, we see a gradual change in the way in which these peptides bind and make holes in the membranes.
And why is this important in terms of developing antibiotics?
If we can use these techniques to understand the mechanism whereby the peptides bind to the membranes, we can use that information to design better peptide antibiotics.
As well as linear dichroism, do you use other spectroscopic techniques to study these peptides? And if so, what do they add to the picture?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, we do use other techniques, and I believe it's very important to use lots of different techniques when you're looking at these types of interactions. They all give you slightly different types of information. For example, the linear dichroism spectroscopy tells you about the orientation of the peptide relative to the membrane. A related technique called circular dichroism spectroscopy, where you use circularly polarized light instead of linearly polarized light, tells you about the shape of the protein. So it tells you about how the protein's folded up.
Sorry, so how linear dichroism and circular dichroism seem like very similar things. How can you get different information just by changing the way the light is oriented?
Circularly polarized light will only be absorbed by things that have got a handedness, a chirality. So circularly polarized light interacts with things that are in a helical conformation, so like a spiral. A lot of biological molecules have a handedness, so they have a...
like a left or right handedness?
Yeah, so they'll either coil one way in a spiral or coil another way. And the way in which the circularly polarized light interacts with these gives us information on the shape and the conformation of the proteins.
So you use circular dichroism, and that gives you information on the chirality of these molecules. What other techniques do you use?
Another useful technique that we use a lot is fluorescence spectroscopy. And fluorescence is a phenomenon whereby you can shine light at certain types of molecules. It absorbs that light and then emits light at a different wavelength or at a different colour. A lot of proteins are fluorescent, and they're fluorescent because some of the amino acids that are the building blocks of proteins have fluorescent properties. One in particular, tryptophan, is useful to us because it changes its fluorescent properties depending on if it's floating around in water or if it's bound to a lipid membrane. So we can use fluorescent spectroscopy to tell us the environment of the peptide, whether it's floating in solution or bound to the membrane. We can use circular dichroism spectroscopy to tell us the conformation or the shape of the peptide. And we can use linear dichroism spectroscopy to tell us the orientation of the peptide when it's bound to the membrane, if it's sitting on the surface or whether it's bound across the membrane. We can combine those three types of information and how they change over a period of time and under different conditions of concentration and different lipid conditions, to give us clues to the mechanism that the peptides use to make holes in the membrane.
And so by understanding better how these peptides make holes, are you hoping that this will lead to better antibiotics being designed?
Yes, exactly. So once we understand the mechanisms, we can begin to change the antibiotic peptides and study how that changes their properties of, say, binding to the membrane, how it changes how fast they can make holes in the membrane, and most importantly, how we can design in better specificity. They bind to the bacterial membranes much better than they bind to the human membranes.
So this would result in drugs which have far fewer side effects, is that right?
Yes,
Another part of your work is involved in actually designing, developing these instruments and spectrometers. What kind of things have you been able to do?
Often one of the important considerations in research in biomolecules is the availability of material. We often only have very small amounts of these materials to work with, either because they've been purified from a natural source, and once you've purified them, you only end up with a tiny amount. There'll often be financial considerations, because some of these biomolecules are very expensive. So an important thing to be able to do is to be able to work on very small amounts of material. And that's one of the key advances that we at Warwick have made in linear dichroism spectroscopy. It's now possible to work with samples 100 times smaller than we could do previously. And that's really exciting, because it means that we can work on systems that we couldn't work on before. And that's how the work on the antibiotic peptides came about. It was simply too expensive and impractical to work on 100 times the amount of material that we're working on now. So the types of improvements we're looking to make in instrumentation are to use smaller amounts of material, and that makes it cheaper. We can do the measurements more quickly. We can make more accurate measurements. And all of those things combined means that we can begin to implement what are called high-throughput techniques. We can make libraries of compounds that have the potential to have antibiotic activity, and we can use automated techniques to make fast, accurate measurements to test each of these in turn. And then the more promising ones we can take, analyse in more detail, and make changes to them in order to make more effective, more specific antibiotic compounds.
How do you see the future of this work in instrument development going the next few years? What kind of projects are you working on?
I think instrument development is always an exciting area to work in, because it's an incremental process where you can always make improvements on the previous instrumentation. The types of things we're looking at investigating are based around the linear dichroism techniques, which enable us to look at systems that are difficult to look at by many of the other techniques. So we're talking about membrane and protein interactions, fibrous proteins. A lot of fibrous proteins are involved in diseases like Alzheimer's. We also use spectroscopic techniques to look at DNA and drug interactions. So a lot of anti-cancer drugs involve compounds that interact with DNA. And by using these spectroscopic techniques, we can work out how the drugs interact with the DNA and use that information to design more effective drugs.
Dr. Matt Hicks, thank you very much.
Thank you.